Chapter 39. His smashed and bloodied ship fell towards us. With no pseudo-thrust, and nothing but the ghost-thin friction of interstellar space to slow her down, Midnight Queen could only coast, not accelerate. One part in a thousand less than the speed of light was mercurially swift by the standards of almost any other physical object in the universe. But Dalliance and the other ships of the pursuit squadron were now traveling slightly faster. Gallingale's wounded craft had no choice but to tumble back along the opposite vector, and soon it would fall within attack range of our ships. "We kill him," Sorrel said. "No ifs, no buts. We don't even let the bastard explain his actions. Just open fire." "I'm first in line," Charlock said, still bruised from the loss of Steel Breeze. Gallingale, as far as he was concerned, was just as much to blame for the demise of his ship as the robots. He wanted something to punch. I understood how he felt, but I kept thinking how good it would feel to get Gallingale's throat between my hands and keep squeezing. I would make it nice and slow, ebbing the breath from his lungs across the same stretch of time it had taken Seifel to fall from her room. She had known she was going to die, that no agency in the universe could prevent it. Let Gallingale taste something of the same furnace-dry certainty. A long-range strike from a gamma cannon was never going to give the same satisfaction. But Bettany said quietly, "We could use his ship. Maybe we can use Gallingale, too, if he still has something useful to tell us. But we can definitely use the ship." "It's damaged," I said. "But fixable. Everything's fixable, especially given the resources we still have aboard our own ships. Midnight Queen was always the fastest, out of all those that survived the ambush, excepting Silverwings, of course. Midnight's out of the race now, obviously, but that doesn't mean her engine's useless. If we can pull her in, fix her, or recover the drive components, it may make a difference. None of our ships will be able to close the gap if Silverwings pulls ahead again. Midnight Queen could still be able." I hated it, but I knew he was right. Bettany's got a point. "How about we spear him with a gamma cannon and then pick through the remains?" Agrimony asked, as if that was a reasonable proposal. Bettany acted as if he had not heard him. "I'll intercept Midnight Queen with Adonis Blue. I'll only need to make a small course correction to meet her. I'm the only one aboard my ship, so there's no need to put anyone else's life in danger." "Adonis Blue isn't big enough to carry Midnight Queen," I said. "Matter of fact, Dalliance is about the only remaining ship with a hold large enough." "I have Lampreys. They'll match velocity with Gallingale's wreck and drag it back home. We'll worry about the hold afterwards." "I'm coming with you," I said. "You don't have to, Campion. Let the risk be mine." "No, I'm coming." Before he could raise another objection, I said, "Do you have an intercept course worked out already?" "Yes," he said equivocally, "but I'm still not happy with your choice." "Get over it. You know it makes more sense to take Dalliance. Frankly, I don't even need you at all." "Then I suppose this is stalemate." Bettany held my gaze, daring me to blink, then shook his head in disgust or defeat or some weary combination of the two. "Follow me. Shock Diamond, Snowstorm and Chromatic Aberration hold the pursuit course. We'll rejoin you as soon as we have the wreck." Adonis Blue veered away sharply, not so much breaking acceleration safeguards as forgetting about them completely. The old Dalliance could never have kept up with her, but she was more agile since Ateshka's upgrading. From my position in the bridge I watched the other three ships fall into the distance, time lag stretching until they were a third of a second away. Adonis Blue swerved again, and then resumed its original course, except that it was now moving along a parallel vector. As near as could be judged, it was now on a precise collision course with the out-of-control Midnight Queen. "Did you have your suspicions?" Bettany asked me as we waited for the wreck to tumble within intercept reach of the Lampreys. "About Gallingale, I mean." There was something comradely and confiding in his tone, as if I had finally absolved myself in his eyes. "Not an inkling," I told the Imago. "Me neither. I can't help but think of that as a failing, you know. I thought I had my finger on the pulse of the line. I thought I knew all of us, even before the ambush. After it happened, and the line was whittled down to so few of us, I felt I knew every surviving Shatterling as well as I knew myself. We always suspected there was a snake. After Seifel died, there wasn't much doubt. But if it's any consolation, I'd never have fingered Gallingale as the culprit. even after that business with Ugarit Panth. I thought that was your mess, not his. Well, maybe I started it, but it gave Gallingale the perfect excuse to push the ambassador over the edge. He showed him the entry for the consentiency in the UA, established beyond all doubt that the ambassador's civilization was extinct. Could have been an innocent mistake, Bettany started. On second thoughts, probably not. Nothing innocent about it. Gallingale wasn't the first shatling Ugarit Pant spoke to, fishing for information after my indiscretion. But Gallingale was the only one who came up with the idea of letting him see the UA rather than the Troves. The ambassador told me he'd been interested in seeing inside the UA before he went to Gallingale. But I can't help wondering if there wasn't a degree of manipulation going on there. Gallingale just happening to mention the UA, or making sure someone else mentioned it within earshot of the ambassador? It served his purpose. He was able to disclose the real facts about the ambassador's home civilization without implicating himself. At best, he would get away with it without anyone knowing he'd suggested it. At worst, it would just look like another indiscretion. Ugarit Panth came to me, Bettany. Told me what had happened. I could have acted then, but instead I agreed to protect Gallingale. I felt sorry for the bastard. I kept seeing myself in his shoes. Whereas all along what he was hoping for, counting on, was the ambassador taking it so badly that he triggered the suicide mechanism inside his own body while still inside Ymir. That would have taken care of the rest of Gentian line pretty effectively. And Gallingale as well, Bettany said. Not necessarily. He could easily have contrived a reason to leave the planet in a hurry if he suspected the ambassador was going to blow. In fact, that's exactly what he did do. The day after Seifel's funeral, Gallingale very conveniently managed to get himself assigned to patrol duty. He must have been hoping the ambassador would kill most of us. Afterwards, he would have been able to pick off any survivors from space. But he didn't know about Cadence and Cascade's plans. No. They took us all by surprise. Of course he would have been hoping they would die along with the rest of us, but at least he was already in space, in a fast ship and in a good position to embark on the chase. We should have seen all this. But we didn't, so there's no point burdening ourselves with recriminations. Maybe if I'd picked up on Seifel's clue sooner than I did. Don't you start. It's bad enough that one of us feels he could have done more. We're human, Campion. That's all it boils down to. Human and not nearly as clever as we thought we were when it counted. End of story. When they put up the gravestone for our species, that'll be the epitaph. You think anyone will be around to care? Bettany opened his mouth to reply when something caught his attention. I heard the chime of an alert. Here it comes, Campion. I'm releasing lampreys. I watched the bright sparks erupt from the fat green hull of Adonis Blue and streak away in hyphens of light, decelerating massively to reach the rest frame of Gallingale's wreck. I dropped 20 lampreys of my own and sent them to assist. Dalliance had had plenty of time to replace those lost in the passage through the reunion system when I had been attacked by the ambushers. The lampreys needed no direct supervision from us. They were fully capable of grasping the nature and specifics of their task, which was to fasten onto the wreck, stabilize it as well as they could, and then haul it back into the accelerated frame of Dalliance and Adonis Blue. All Bettany and I were required to do was watch the proceedings with nervous impatience, aware that we were falling slowly behind the rest of the pursuit squadron, and would have to sacrifice even more of the already tattered safety margin to make up the distance. "We keep him at arm's length," I said, "until we know he's dead and hasn't set his ship to self-destruct on us." I got the impression you'd have quite liked to get your hands on him. Was it that obvious? A few minutes later, a chime signaled that the lampreys had made contact with Midnight Queen, approached and locked onto her hull without encountering resistance. Bettany and I surveyed the damaged ship, both of us doubting that Gallingale could have survived the attack unless he was in abeyance. Acres of her hull had been peeled away, revealing knotted, vulnerable innards. "Maybe we should abandon it now," Bettany said, as images of the mangled craft played before our eyes. "There can't be much left to salvage from that." "The drive kernel might be tiny and well-shielded," I said, as if he did not know that already. "We've come this far. I'm not going back empty-handed." The lampreys began to haul the wreck towards our ships. I drummed my fingers, my heart in my throat. We should send a probe aboard it. No time, dear boy. There are a million places Gallingale might have hidden himself away. It would take us weeks to search every nook and cranny of his ship. He was right. I just did not want to be reminded of the alternative, if a physical search was out of the question. This could be a ruse. Which is why it would have been a much better idea for you to remain with the other ships. But there was no rancor in his voice. If anything, he appeared grateful for my company. I'm going to bring Adonis Blue in close. I'll be ready for an attack, but I won't raise impasse until the last moment. That way at least we'll know one way or the other. I don't like this. No one's asking you to like it. What matters is that you mustn't stay around if things turn unpleasant. If I can't handle myself, you aren't going to make much difference. Race back to the other three ships and see what you can do en masse. Maybe then you can help me. But one ship must survive to continue the pursuit. That's imperative. We're agreed on that. There's been no word from Purslane since Gallingale attacked Silverwings, but... she's alive. Don't ever doubt that. Bettany allowed the lampreys to drag their dead prize closer to Adonis Blue. I held Dalliance's position, keeping a clear 10,000 kilometers between our two vessels. Bettany's toad-shaped ship was larger than Midnight Queen, but not by such a margin that he could have swallowed her inside his hold. He remained on pseudo-thrust and brought his weapons to attack readiness, but kept his impasse lowered. 10 more lampreys sprang from his hull to provide skein thrust, should he need to raise the shield. There was 100 kilometers between the two ships, then 10. At 1 kilometer, squashed together by my angle of view, they already appeared hopelessly fused, as if they had rammed together. I saw it a moment before I saw Bettany's reaction. Either he was slow, or his impasso was not as effective as he had let us believe, taking valuable fractions of a second to reach operating strength. The ruined hull of Midnight Queen, the hull I had already observed to be peeling away in damaged plaques, exposing delicate insides, splintered apart in an explosion of curved and jagged shards. The instant it happened, I diagnosed it as a catastrophic, terminal failure of the ship's integrity. Midnight Queen finally breaking up, stresses picking apart her ruined corpse. The next instant, I saw the truth. The vulnerable innards were merely another layer of camouflage that peeled away in the same eruption. There was another hull under all that deception, dark, sleek, intact, a dagger within a dagger. I screamed a warning to Bettany. It was too late. The damage was already done. His impasse raised, but not swiftly enough to prevent chunks of that deceitful armor from raining onto Adonis Blue, gouging vicious wounds into her own hull. Then a long row of weapons emplacements sprang open along the vicious edge of Gallingale's dark new ship, turning it into a savagely barbed instrument, and at least a dozen gamma cannon muzzles rammed forth and concentrated their fire on Bettany's vessel. The impasse deflected some of that energy, flickering like an electric blue bubble as the photons downshifted into the optical, curdling with thick, squirming lightning as field asymmetries washed over its volume. But the attack was sustained and at devastatingly close range, and Adonis Blue had already been wounded by the hull shards. Despite all this, Bethany's lampreys started returning fire, whiplashing around the other ship, etching coils of light as their skein drives gashed space to its fierce marrow, stabbing at the strobing impasse Gallingale had raised around his own ship. Occasionally, when their discharges coincided with a lull in the strobing field, they found their mark, but the impacts did less damage to that dark hull than I would have anticipated, picking it away in dark scabs but never reaching through to anything vital. Denied the ability to use pseudo-thrust at full efficiency, both ships began to fall out of my accelerated reference frame. Their impasses were merging, forming a dumbbell shape as they tried to establish a minimum surface area solution. I was reminded of ancient sailing ships engaged in close-quarters combat, their rigging tangling up, locking the two adversaries together unto the death. A scratchy voice, not even an imago, said, "Get out of here, Campion! Get out of here now!" "Bettany," I began. "Just go," he said. "Follow Purslane. Bring her home. Tell her I made a terrible mistake and that I'm sorry." I spun Dalliance around and boosted away from the two embattled ships, the console shrill with warnings of my imminent doom. I had crossed less than half the distance back to the other shatterlings, when one or the other of the two battling ships became a scalding point of light, swelling until it had filled the entire misshapen double-lobed impasso bubble with stained white radiance. The radiance tore against the limit of the bubble, and then punched through with the fury of a miniature supernova. It was axiomatic that no ship, no part of a ship, could have survived such energies. Bettany had sacrificed himself, done one last deed for the line he loved so much. He had made errors and enemies, he had miscalculated and misjudged, but, in my eyes at least, in the last instant of his existence, he had redeemed himself utterly. But he had not killed Gallingale. We did not see it at first. It was camouflaged to the point of invisibility and small enough to register as just another piece of fused debris spinning away from that fireball. It was Henbane who grew suspicious and turned Shock Diamond away to investigate, vowing to rejoin the chase when he had satisfied his curiosity. What he found was a black egg, wrapped in a shell of impasse. It was no more than 10 meters across, and appeared to lack any means of moving or steering itself. We knew exactly what it was. Gallingale had hoped to escape, to fall through space until he felt it was safe to signal his presence. 1,000 years from now, 10,000, 50,000, he would be hurtling through the airspace of another part of the meta-civilization, separated by time and space from the knowledge of his crimes. He would alert the locals to rescue him, and they would gladly oblige, even if it meant pushing their science to the limits of ingenuity, even if it took them centuries or thousands of years to accomplish their task. None of that would matter to Gallingale, as long as someone found him before he sailed beyond the edge of the galaxy. Henbane signaled him. Some dull mechanism brought Gallingale out of abeyance. His imago appeared on all our ships, beaming with delight at his own survival. In tongue, he said, "Greetings, co-sentients of the human meta-civilization. I am..." There was the briefest of pauses as he searched his mind for a new name, something other than Gallingale. "Campion, a shatterling of Gentian line, a survivor of the ambush against our line. I have been traveling for a very long time, ever since my ship was destroyed at near-light speed. Humbly I beseech your assistance in decelerating me to planetary speeds, so that I may recontact any other survivors of this most heinous of crimes. My survival pod carries a trove rich in the science and culture of a million societies, the contents of which I would be glad to share with anyone in a position to assist me." He folded his hands across his lap and beamed again. "I await your response with interest." "Hello, Gallingale," Henbane said. "Sorry to spoil things, but you haven't been asleep quite as long as you planned. A little under an hour, if you want the brutal truth." It must only have been then that Gallingale paid proper attention to the chronometer in the cramped little space of his survival pod. He let out a sound that was almost a laugh, as if acknowledging the cosmic joke that had just been played on him. "Quite," he said. "I don't think Campion's going to be too thrilled about that little white lie you just told." "I'm certain he won't." Gallingale scratched the border of his metal eye. "Sorry, Campion, if you're listening in. Had to do it. It's not as if I could go around calling myself Gallingale anymore, is it?" "I'd have found you eventually," I said. "Given your evident determination, that wouldn't have surprised me. But do you know what? It was all for nothing. I didn't stop the robots, and I don't think you're going to stop them either." "Why did you do it?" I asked. "The same reason we do anything, because it's what I believe in. The House of Suns matters more to me than the House of Flowers. The House of Flowers is just one part of the commonality. Take it away, and the whole stack of cards wouldn't come tumbling down. But the House of Suns underpins everything." I asked, "What is the House of Suns?" "What you always believed it to be. Another line, operating in secrecy, created by the commonality to make sure our involvement in the extinction of the first machine stayed a secret. Nice name, by the way," he smiled. "Yes, I was listening in on Perslane's conversation. She didn't say anything about us being involved in any extinction. She just said they died out." "Yes, and she was keeping something from you. She'd have had her reasons, but the sad sordid truth of it is that we stabbed the first machines in the back, gave them the poison chalice, made them die in agony just like the ghost soldiers in Palatial. We didn't really mean for them all to drop dead, but that's no excuse, is it? We were looking for the means to kill them, and all of a sudden, oh dear, we did kill them. I absorbed this truth provisionally, slotting it into a mental file but not yet making any emotional connection with it. How did the House of Suns operate? Where's Bettany? He asked suddenly. Bettany's dead. That's why I'm asking the questions. Poor old Bettany. He did his bit, you know. Just didn't have quite what it took. I'm still waiting for an answer to my question. He exhaled a massive, world-weary sigh. The House of Suns was designed to enforce and police the line's self-administered amnesia. It wasn't enough just to forget about the crime we committed against the first machines. Gentian Line, and the other complicit lines, had to be actively prevented from rediscovering the evidence of that crime, so that's what we did. For 5 million years, ever since the lines decided to wipe the story of the first machines from their collective histories, we've been in the shadows, waiting and watching. We've always known the truth. Someone had to be trusted with it. It's been our duty to monitor the activities of the lines and any other high-level civilizations and make sure no one ever puts the pieces of that puzzle back together. And for 4 of those 5 million years, it really wouldn't have mattered that much if anyone had. We're human. We'd have got over ourselves. But then the machine people emerged, I said. That changed everything. What would you rather have had, Campion? Peace or war? That's how simple it was. We couldn't stop the Vigilance collecting data, but most of what they discovered never found its way outside their archives. Then you came along, worked your way into their graces and discovered something damaging. We knew then that we had no choice. At the next reunion, Gentian Line had to be wiped out. It was brutal, but what else could we do? The problem was, the machine people already knew. They only had suspicions. We weren't to know that, but it wouldn't have changed anything if we had. You never suspected that Cadence and Cascade were agents, though. Did anyone? You've got a point. Did you know about the Stardam? About their plans to crack it open? Not at all. But I knew of the Stardam. That was something else we were supposed to be monitoring. What I didn't know was that the opener was in Purslane's possession. His good eye flared at my incomprehension. It's been 5 million years, Campion. Things are forgotten, even when you're trying very hard to remember them. We were sowing so much misinformation that some of it came back and bit us. We thought the opener had been destroyed circuits ago, or lost. We had no idea it was still in the line's possession, even less that it had survived the ambush. But the robots knew where to look. You know what that means? Before I could answer, he leaned forward in his seat, his face glistening with a film of sweat. They've had spies inside the line, so deeply embedded that even the House of Suns didn't know about them. Learning our secrets, finding out things about us even we didn't know, such as the fact that Purslane is the custodian of the opener. You can kill me now. I won't blame you. But understand this. No matter what you think of me, Silver Wings of Morning cannot be allowed to reach that Stardam. We'll do what we can to prevent that. You don't understand. I'm not even sure Purslane does, despite what she obviously knows. What she told you about the first machines being trapped inside that thing. Yes. That's not the whole story. Our reserves of patience are rapidly diminishing, Charlock said. It's a Stardam. That part is true. But it wasn't put there just to contain the robots. Don't you think we'd have found a way to wipe them out if we'd been able to shepherd them into such a small volume of space? We'd have used H-guns on them and turned them into a ball of molten slag. The thought had occurred, I said. The Stardam doesn't contain the first machines. They're somewhere else. It doesn't hold a dying star either. What it contains is a door, a mouth, an aperture. Galengale's pale tongue licked his bloodless, snake-pale lips. The Priors made it, while we were still spineless slugs swimming around in the oceans of the Cambrian period. They cracked the causality problem, found a way to open a wormhole large enough for macroscopic transits, that doesn't suffer from the information censorship bottleneck of our own little efforts. You can't crack the causality problem, I said. It's built into the deep structure of reality. They found a way, Campion. Trust me on this. Interstellar transits weren't the problem. They were happy with relativistic flight the way we are. 200,000 years to complete a circuit around the galaxy. It's really not that long once you get into the swing of things. But to travel to Andromeda, or one of the galaxies in the local group, different story. Then you're looking at millions of years. Fuck, we've only been doing language for 6.5. Time to get to Andromeda and back. Just, still not enough time to make a second trip, even if we had a mind to do it. That wasn't acceptable to the Priors, so they built a wormhole connection between the two galaxies. It's been there since they vanished, dormant, but functionally intact. At the time of the first machines, it wasn't even recognized for what it was. It was only when they vanished that the nature of the door was established. Did the first machines use it to escape to Andromeda? He smiled at my question. Close, but not quite. They got there under their own power at sublight speed. We're only talking about a small number of survivors, you understand. For a long time, the fact that they'd escaped, that the lines couldn't track them down and finish them off, because the survivors had to be finished off, even if most of the deaths had been accidental, simply wasn't an issue. They were heading to Andromeda. Nothing could catch up with them, but at least they weren't our problem anymore. Let them get to where they were going. We had our galaxy, they could have theirs. No one expected them to survive and thrive and start doing things. The absence, I said. Galingale nodded gravely. Until then the robots were a distant concern. They'd made no efforts to signal their existence, and as far as the rest of the galaxy was concerned, Andromeda was still uninhabited. But when the absence happened, we knew things were taking a new turn. So what is the absence? The signal that the wormhole had been reactivated. From that moment on, the House of Suns was faced with a crisis on two fronts. We had to prevent knowledge of the earlier atrocity from ever reaching the present machine people. And we had to deal with the possibility that the remnants of the first machines were preparing to return home. We couldn't deactivate the wormhole. It was far beyond our understanding. But at least we had the Star Dam in place, our last and only line of defense. Fortunately, it was enough. We could be confident that nothing would ever be able to break through that containment. If a Star Dam can hold back the fury of a supernova, no weapon known to line science could ever penetrate it. It was holding, too. In all the years since the absence, nothing has ever broken through. And now? Work it out, Campion. Cadence and Cascade want the opener so that they can release the first machines back into our galaxy. That's why it's so vital to stop them. You're not just dealing with a few pissed-off robots that have been stuck inside a box for 5 million years. There's an entire galaxy's worth of them waiting to pour on through. Oh, and I think we can take it as a given that they're not going to be in a reconciliatory mood. We'll do what we can, I said. But you won't do anything that might hurt Purslane. You were prepared to kill her. It didn't make much difference to the outcome. I only had one ship, Campion. You have four. But what do I care? It's your problem now, not mine. I've told you everything I know. Not because I give a damn what you think of me, but because I want you to understand how important it is to stop Silverwings. But I'm done now. I've said my piece. You can go ahead and kill me. You seem very resigned to it, Charlock said. What choice have I got? Even with its impasse raised, this pod wouldn't survive a concentrated attack from your ships for very long. Charlock shrugged. No, it probably wouldn't. I think I'd sooner it was quick. I shall put myself in abeyance, then I won't know a thing. Do what you will with me. Charlock nodded. We will. Galingale reached out of view and touched a control. Restraints whirred, sucking him deeper into his chair. He braced himself like a man expecting an electric shock. Then the red cocoon of stasis locked around him. We can draw straws if you like, Charlock said. For who gets to kill him? Asked Tansy. For who gets to take him back to Naomi? One of us has to abandon the chase and return home. He said he'd told us everything, but we'd be fools to take him at his word. I agree, I said. Not that I'm not up for a chase, Sorrel said, but Snowstorm's already pushed to the limit. I'm not going to be much good if Silverwings pulls some thrust out of the bag. He glanced at Orash, who was sharing his ship. Nothing in her expression said she disagreed with him. Someone has to go back, I said. It might as well be Sorrel. Anyone else who doesn't want to stick around for the chase, I suggest you make arrangements to whisk over to Snowstorm as soon as you can. Really, though, I think you all should go. Dalliance is at least as fast as any of the remaining ships. There's no reason for the rest of you to be dragged halfway across the galaxy. I'd much rather see this through, Tansy said. Me too, Henbane echoed, after a moment's reflection. Then I'll take Galingale back to Naume, Sorrel said. One of us has to go back and let them know what happened out here. They'll never entirely believe anything in a signal, but when I show up in the flesh, I think they'll listen. He singled me out, our eyes meeting for a moment, and said, I'll speak well of Purslane, Campion, and you, of course. I'll let the doubters know they were wrong. One day she'll get to tell them in person. Good luck, Sorrel. Get back to Naume. Help the line consolidate. I think it's safe to say that we're going to be out of touch for a while. But we're still Gentian. Sooner or later you'll find a way to get a message to us. I don't doubt that for a second. In a way I'm almost envious of you, I said. Missing the singing dunes of Naume already? Not exactly. But I'd give a lot to see the look on Galingale's face when they pull him out of stasis, especially if the first person he sees is Miserion, sharpening her knives. Chapter 40. Beyond the window, the white-walled room was still as a painting. Occasionally my eyes convinced me that there was a flicker of subliminal movement, but I soon learned not to trust them. At my current level of time compression, Hesperus would have had to spend many hours in the same position just to register to my senses. There was no reason to assume he was out there at all, unless the casket relinquished control to me, as it had refused to do after the stasis first took hold. I stood a very good chance of dying in there. This thought was chasing its tail through my head for the 1,000th or 10,000th time, when the casket's voice calmly informed me that the transition to real time was imminent. Stasis ratio is now 100,000 and falling, it said. 10,000 and falling. Field stability optimal. The field dialed down from 10,000 to 1,000, through the hundreds, into the tens, and then released me. The chair's bindings eased apart, allowing me to slip my hands and feet out of the hoops. I could move my head again. My neck and spine felt as if they had calcified together. I did not like stasis. The door opened with a huff of air and the chair emerged from the casket. Pushing the discomfort aside, I eased myself to my feet, keeping one hand on the back of the chair for support. It was less than 24 subjective hours since I had last been in that room, but if the cabinet had kept me at a stasis level of 1,000,000 for the entire duration of my confinement, the better part of 3,000 years had passed aboard the Ark. I hobbled to a wall and scuffed my hand against the white material, with the absurd expectation that a film of dust might have built up there. My fingertips came away forensically clean. Every surface in the room gleamed with polished newness, as if it was only minutes old. Hesperus? I called, my voice hoarse until I cleared my throat and tried again. Hesperus! It's Purslane. I'm out. There was no answer. I breathed in the ancient, still air. There were atoms in the room that had not been through a human lung for 30 centuries. Something caught my eye in the adjoining room, visible through the open doorway, a flash of color and glass. My legs still unsteady, I made my cautious way out of the casket room. I found a white table set for me, with a white chair next to it. Breakfast had been served. There was a glass of freshly squeezed orange juice, a croissant on a plate, a pot of coffee and a bowl of fruit. There was a bunch of flowers in a vase and a folded white card like a menu. I touched the croissant and found that it was still warm. I sniffed the coffee. It was dark and strong, the way I liked it, and boiling hot. I pulled the seat out and sat down, grateful to rest my wobbly legs for a while. I poured some of the coffee into a white china cup and held it to my nose, taking in the aroma before I allowed myself a sip. I tore off the end of the croissant and stuffed it into my mouth. After a day in the stasis casket, I was ravenous. After the first bite, I could not stop myself. I finished off the croissant and three pieces of fruit. I gulped down the juice and drank two cups of coffee. Only then did I open the stiff white card. Inside was a message in fine gold writing. It was written in very elegant script, but just a touch too precise to have ever been the work of a human hand. Hesperus had signed it, but there had been no need. He told me that he was sorry he could not be with me on the day of my emergence from stasis, but that he was unavoidably detained elsewhere. He had arranged for the Ark's robot janitors to prepare this breakfast just before my stasis interval was due to expire. He trusted it was to my taste, insofar as he had been able to judge it. At the time he had issued the instructions, he wrote, my emergence still lay many centuries in the future, but he had been confident that the janitors would execute their orders with due scrupulousness, as he had requested. I cannot be certain that I will still be alive when you read this, Hesperus had written. If I am, then you will find me on the bridge of Silverwings doing what I may. I should very much like to see you, but circumstances dictate that you must come to me, not the other way around. Before you do, I would urge you to examine the Ark's cargo hold. I believe you will find the contents illuminating. Before you leave the Ark itself, you must make an assessment of the present dangers. If all is well, you will see an abundance of golden threads leading out of the cargo bay. If you follow them, they will bring you to me. If there are white threads only, it will not be safe for you. If there are golden and white threads, you would be advised to exercise caution. Use the whiskways only if you have no other choice. Almost as an afterthought, he had added, I have had the maker prepare a spacesuit suitable for your needs. I trust you will find it satisfactory, and I look forward to renewing our acquaintance. I remain your friend, Hesperus. Thank you, I said quietly. I finished my breakfast. Then I emptied my bladder, bathed, and had a maker prepare me a change of clothes. Only then did I start looking around the Ark for other messages he might have left. It was not long before I encountered one of the threads. I was walking down a corridor, trying to find the spacesuit, when I came across an obstruction that had not been there before. A fist-thick cable punched its way from one wall to the other at chest height. It was white and as smooth as an icicle, but the way the wall material had splintered around the intrusion made me doubtful that it was part of the Ark's own systems. Not long afterwards I found another white branch, this time running across the floor and forking in two directions. One fork plunged into the floor, the other curved up the wall and went through the ceiling. I walked on, a feeling of dread churning in my stomach. In the next large room I found a cross-knitted tangle of white and gold cables, rupturing through various surfaces, stretching through the air in different directions like the strands of a monstrous cobweb. I had to pick and fight my way through the tangle. The cables were stiff and hard. Some of the white ones were wrapped around the gold and vice versa. It was like vines trying to strangle a larger trunk. Although everything was still, I had the sense that this was a frozen moment in a titanic struggle. It was the same everywhere I went. In some parts of the Ark, the white cables dominated, in others the gold. In various critical areas, the white and gold cables were competing for control. Here and there I found a cable that came to an abrupt, severed end. I kept thinking of Cadence, pushing tendrils from her wounds, trying to connect with any useful system aboard the Ark so that she could work mischief. I was seeing the evidence of something similar, but on a much larger scale. I remembered Hesperus's recommendation that I visit the Ark's cargo bay. I would not have considered going there at all if he hadn't suggested it, my memory insisting that it was as empty as the rest of the ancient liner. But now that he had planted the thought in my mind, I felt a dark compulsion guiding me onwards, as if I was sleepwalking towards a destination known only to my subconscious mind. The going became increasingly difficult, the density of white and gold cables doubling and redoubling, until it was all I could do to squeeze through the narrow interstices. There were parts of the Ark that they had left well alone, and parts that they were still fighting for. The cargo hold was clearly of paramount importance. Eventually the obstructions thinned out, It was as if I had passed into the eye of the storm, and I found a window offering a view through a thick wall into what should have been the unlit space of the hold. The hold was not unlit today, but the light coming through that window was not as steady as I would have expected. It was flickering, tinged with blue and violet. I looked into the hold, squinting against the brightness. The Ark's hold was not empty at all. Suspended in the middle, occupying most of its length, was a machine that was both instantly recognizable and deeply unfamiliar to me. It was a series of 8 brass-colored spheres, joined together as if on a spit. The spheres, each of which was easily 100 meters across, were as reflective as mirrors and entirely featureless. I was looking at the single-use opener. It was floating against the Ark's interior gravity, suspended by its own levators. It was also generating an impasse, 8 spherical bubbles merging into a kind of crimped sausage shape. I could trace the quivering surface of the impasse by the energies flickering across it, forming transient spectral patterns like oil on water. Weapons were arranged around the opener, directing their fire against the impasse. There were a larger version of the energy pistol that the Maker had created for me, floating in the air, each weapon trailing a gold cable back into the gold nervous system that Hesperus had cobwebbed around the inside of the bay. I realized then that I must always have known that the opener was in the Ark. When I chose this ship as our place of refuge, my subconscious had been directing me, knowing that the robots would be wary of attacking the Ark if they suspected the opener was inside it. And if I had known of the opener, then I had also known of the star dam it was made for. On that level, I must also have known of my complicity in the extinction of the first machines, long before I needed it spelled out. I left the opener and navigated back through the Ark until I reached a gold-threaded area where Hesperus had established clear control. It was there that I found the spacesuit, waiting by a high-capacity Maker. Hesperus had done well. The suit was an exact fit, and although it was a very long time since I had worn one, the memories came back soon enough. "Hello, Perslane," the helmet said as it lit up with status icons. "I would have spoken to you sooner, but I could not find an easy route into your skull. I was hoping you would find the suit eventually." I smiled. For all my fears, for all that I did not know if I would ever see Campion or the other Shatterlings again, it was still good to hear his voice. "You're all right." "And so are you, I trust." There was something evasive about his answer, I thought. "I am sorry to have kept you in abeyance for so long, but I believed it was in your best interests. There really was no sense in you remaining conscious for the entire voyage, even if that could have been arranged. After Galingale's attack..." He was talking about something that had happened thousands of years ago. To me, it was yesterday's news. "What happened?" "He was unsuccessful." "In killing me or in slowing Silverwings?" "Neither objective was achieved. Galingale met greater resistance than he had anticipated. His ship was damaged. It fell back towards the other vehicles. There was an altercation, during which unpleasantness, Bettany's ship was destroyed. I learned this from Campion during our subsequent conversations." "You've been in touch with Campion?" "Not recently, but I have every confidence that he is still alive. His ship, Dalliance, has been following us ever since."
"And the others?"
"They've all gone now, Perslane. Dalliance is the last one left. But Campion is alive, I am sure of it. He must be in abeyance, awaiting news of a change in our status. Very shortly he will have it."
"Where are we?"
"Approaching the Star Dam. We have travelled 62,000 years from Naomi."
It was the longest crossing I had ever made, in all the circuits, since I had left the Golden Hour for the first time. Although I had been half expecting this news, it still triggered a demoralizing psychic vertigo. Human beings were not meant for this kind of thing. We had evolved to grub around within a few kilometers of the same village, in the same time zone, under the same fixed stars. "You mentioned that it might not be safe for me to come to see you," I said.
"I think you may. Take care, but do not be unduly concerned. The Whiskways are safe now. I have secured them in readiness. Come up to the bridge. There is much to discuss."
I left the Ark, but not without trepidation. Stepping outside for the first time since Cadence and Hesperus had fought each other, I kept expecting to find one of her severed limbs inching across the floor, dragging itself along by a fine silver thread. But that incident lay tens of thousands of years in the past as far as the ship was concerned. All around me, the bay appeared superficially unchanged, the same looming vastness, ceiling and walls kilometers distant, a volume large enough to swallow the White Ark, with its own huge cargo, and make it look tiny. But a second glance told me that nothing was as I had left it. Every visible ship in the bay was covered in a gristle of white and gold strands, braided together in thick, fibrous mats. The outlines of the ships were rounded, indistinct, like mansions overrun by foliage. The cables had encroached on every surface, obscuring their true form. Even the White Ark itself was now almost unrecognizable. A forest of cables enveloped the old ship, gold and white, branching and rebranching in dismaying complexity, punching through her barely visible hull in hundreds of places. The door where I emerged was one of the few clear spots. It was encircled by a thick moat of gold cables, keeping the white at bay, and the gold cables extended away from the ark to form a kind of braided tunnel, a passage through the forest floor. "You've been busy," I said.
"It passed the time."
I walked out into the cargo bay, to the nearest whisking point. This part of the ship looked more or less as I remembered it. There was the occasional gold cable, but other than that the walls and surfaces were unchanged. The go board hovered in readiness. I punched for up ship, whisked there in an eye blink, walked from one side of the concourse to the other across the bridge with its kilometers-long central trunk shaft rising and falling above and below. The anvil-shaped machines, normally moving up and down the shaft, were still, bound in vast cobwebs of gold and white. I punched another go-board and reached the bridge.
"I've provided atmosphere," Hesperus said. "It's safe to remove your helmet."
Until that moment I had not known for sure that he was still alive, that the voice I had been hearing was not an impersonation performed by Cascade. But Hesperus was still alive, in a manner of speaking. There were two robots on the bridge, situated more or less opposite one another. Cascade was to my left, his head and torso attached to one wall. Hesperus was on the other side, positioned in a similar fashion. Both robots had lost all their limbs, or, more accurately, had grown so many extensions from their bodies that their limbs had been transformed beyond recognition and duplicated many times over. Cascade was a many-limbed starfish with a humanoid torso and head at his epicenter. Hesperus was a gold star radiating out in all the directions of the compass. The limbs had the thickness of arm or leg joints, where they erupted from all over their bodies, and then tapered down to the diameters of the cables I had already seen. They reached away from the two robots, tangling together where they made contact, forming a dense labyrinthine quilt of white and gold filaments. I tried to follow a single cable, but it was futile. The pattern was too complicated. But I was certain that most, if not all, of the cables eventually found their way out of this room. This was the nerve center. From here, the two robots had extended their bodies to encompass every vital system of Silver Wings and her cargo. They must have consumed and converted thousands, even millions of tons worth of matter, digesting the ship's own fabric, remaking it for their own ends.
"Remove your helmet," Hesperus urged again. "It's quite safe, and we can talk more easily that way."
I did as he suggested. The suit would not have allowed me to undo the helmet unless the air was breathable, but his encouragement was reassuring.
"How long have you been like this?"
"A while."
"Since you put me into abeyance?" He smiled. He was still capable of that.
"No, this state of immobility came much later, within the last 600 years. For a long time I was the way you remember me.
Once you were in abeyance, I began to direct my energies into regaining control of the ship. For many years it was all I could do to keep out of reach of the weapons and tracking devices Cascade sent after me. He was wary of touching the Ark, though. That was when I began to wonder about the location of the opener. Once my suspicions had been aroused, it was an easy matter to locate it. It took only a few centuries of patient investigation.
It was in there all along, just waiting for me to stumble on it.
It was concealed, hidden inside a camouflaging impasse. Unless you had reason to look more closely, you would have seen only an empty cargo bay. You probably did look in there on more than one occasion in the distant past.
Perhaps, I said doubtfully, it was equally likely that my subconscious had kept me away from the Ark's hold,
knowing the secret it contained. I tried to sabotage the opener, but quickly learned how well protected it was. Someone had gone to extraordinary lengths of ingenuity and resourcefulness to make it sabotage-proof. Her handiwork was marvelous.
It was me, wasn't it?
Very likely.
I cursed myself under my breath. What have you tried?
Everything imaginable. Everything imaginable has failed. As you may have observed, I am attempting to overload the impasse with a concentrated injection of energy. The chances of success are not high. It was simply one more avenue to explore. I have been trying for 370 years.
And the ship? I asked. Who's running it now?
Neither of us. After centuries of mere survival, I decided the time had come to attempt to regain control. Cascade was strong, but I was not the simple machine person he imagined me to be. Gradually I wore him down, invading his mind, stripping away his intellect layer by layer. Over centuries I reduced him to a machine vegetable, a box of reflexes. I could not have done so without the gifts I inherited from Valmik.
I looked at the inert white robot on the other side of the room. And now?
I am fighting a mindless entity, but he is not powerless or without stratagems. Before I began to strip away his faculties, he put in place measures that I cannot rescind. The ship is course-locked. It cannot be turned from its current heading.
Can't you overcome him? Disable those measures?
I have been trying to do exactly that, without success, for hundreds of years. He was cleverer than most, Perslane. He must have anticipated my eventual takeover of his mind.
I could get an energy pistol. Shoot him right now.
It would do no good. The ship would still be course-locked, and I would still have to contend with the rest of him.
How close is the Stardam?
We are very near now, less than a light month away. I expect the opener to function very shortly. You can see the dam if you wish.
Without waiting for my answer, Hesperus caused an image to appear on my main displayer. It was garlanded in white and gold threads, but the surface was still unobstructed. A fountain burst of blue-shifted stars bunched aft, with a magnified circle of perfect darkness punched through the middle of them. You could blue-shift the black of a star dam as much as you liked, and it would still be black.
That's it. Real-time imagery, Hesperus confirmed. The black circle and the space around it swarmed with red icons. What are those things?
Planets.
Ships and defense stations. They've been waiting for us. Once our destination and intention became clear, Gentian Line sent a warning ahead of us, signaling the surrounding communities to guard the Star Dam.
I felt a twinge of betrayal, while knowing that there was nothing else they could have done.
How much warning have they had? A little over 60 years. Just enough time to coordinate a few nearby systems and call in any line-level ships in the neighborhood. It won't stop us, Perslane.
How sure of that are you?
Very sure. I know what this ship can do now. I have seen it smash Charlock, Orash, and Agrimony's ships. Later it swatted Galingale aside. His ship carried more and better weapons than any of the others, and still it made no difference. After that, there were 3 ships following us, Dalliance, Shock Diamond, and Chromatic Aberration. Only Dalliance is left now. The other ships made attempts to slow us down, but Silverwings picked them off effortlessly. They inflicted only minimal damage, easily repaired. From what I have learned concerning the Cordon, the chances of them hurting us, let alone stopping us, are very small. It will be a massacre, and nothing will have changed.
You could be wrong. There could be hidden ships, waiting to emerge from camouflage at the last moment.
There could be, yes. Hesperus hesitated. I took a liberty, Perslane. I hope you will not be angry.
After you locked me in a box for 3,000 years, why would I be angry?
I signaled the Cordon. I am able to control Silverwings to that extent. I explained our situation, that you and I are innocent hostages, unable to influence the course or velocity of this ship, or stop it from responding to hostile overtures. I offered them graphical testimony of what I had already witnessed. I showed them that there is no combination of their forces that stands a chance of stopping us, and that the best they can hope for is massive losses of ships and sentience. I urged them to stand all crewed ships down and rely only on automated attack stations to minimize losses.
Did they listen?
I have received no response, nor have I observed any change in their defensive posture. I believe they received my message, but chose to ignore it.
You can see why they might. For all they know, they are hearing Cadence or Cascade, trying to talk them out of an attack that might actually work.
I am sorry, Purslane. It was the best I could do.
I could try talking to them.
I do not believe it would make any difference now. Your voice and face could be faked just as easily.
I'd still like to try.
Then speak.
Now. The sooner they move out of range of Silverwing's weapons, the fewer losses they will sustain. They cannot stop us, but at least we will not have more blood on our hands. He smiled encouragingly.
Speak, Purslane. Perhaps you can make a difference where I failed.
I'm not sure where to begin. Usually when I address a civilization, I like to know a bit about it. Like, are they bipeds? Do they breathe air? Simple stuff like that.
You don't have that luxury now. The best you can hope for is that these people understand Tung. They probably do, or they would not have acted on the Gentian warning.
All right, then. I cough to clear my throat again. It was still dry despite the breakfast. This is Purslane. I am a Shatterling of Gentian line. You've already heard from my brothers and sisters, I think. You may already have heard from my friend Hesperus. I want you to know that everything you've heard is true. The ship is carrying a single-use opener, and it's aimed at your stardam. If the opener works, we're all in a lot of trouble. Humans, post-humans, every organic sentience in the meta-civilization. That's a given. You're right to try to stop us. If there was a foolproof way of doing it, I'd be encouraging you to go right ahead. But this isn't a battle you can win. Please believe what Hesperus has already told you. That all you'll be doing is flinging machines and people against an unstoppable object. If you have some ultimate weapon we don't know about, 10,000 line ships about to break out of camouflage and open fire with H-guns, then go ahead and use that weapon. But if you don't, I beg you to remove all your crewed ships from the immediate vicinity of the stardam. I fell silent. Hesperus nodded.
That was good, Purslane. You made a very persuasive case.
But they won't listen, will they?
There is always hope.
I dragged fingers through my hair, tangled from the helmet.
Does any of this matter anyway? If we reach the stardam, the lives that will be lost trying to stop us will be a total irrelevance compared to the lives that will be lost afterwards, when the first machines break through.
That is my gravest fear, and the thing I most want to discuss with you.
I thought you wanted me to persuade the cordon to disperse.
The cordon is merely a taste of the worst that could happen. As you say, if the stardam is opened, and the first machines have hostile ambitions, even the loss of an entire civilization would be a mere detail.
They'll have hostile ambitions, wouldn't you?
Revenge is for biologicals, as I have already pointed out.
Tell that to Cadence and Cascade. Revenge was pretty high up their agenda, as far as I could tell.
You have a point.
What do you want to say to me, Hesperus?
That I can stop this ship at any time.
He let that sink in, allowing me a few moments to digest the implications, watching me with those magnificent opal turquoise eyes, until he judged that the moment was right to continue.
My control of Silverwings is still imperfect. I cannot steer her or slow her down. I cannot prevent her from opening fire on friendly forces. But I can destroy her and the opener. I have sufficient control of the White Ark to initiate an excursion event in her engine. As we discussed many centuries ago, Silverwings could not contain such an energy release.
I could only focus on the practicalities of what he was suggesting, not the brutal emotional truth of it. The opener's inside an impasse. Will it survive?
Unlikely. The impasse is strong enough to resist weapons, but not the energies associated with an engine failure.
There's no other way, is there?
No outside agency can stop us. Only we have that means now.
My mind flashed through all the options we had already tried or rejected. Can we abandon ship and trigger the engine remotely?
Abandoning ship is not an option for me, I'm afraid. It would take me much too long to reshape myself, and we have little time left.
I'm sorry.
Regretfully, it is also not an option for you. I cannot disengage the curtain on the cargo bay, nor persuade the door to open. You could exit via one of the passenger locks in a suit, but without a ship you would not survive long.
It's all right. I wouldn't leave you here alone.
That is considerate of you, Purslane.
What would it take? Do you have to make any preparations?
All it needs is a word from you. Tell me to do it, and the ship will cease to exist.
You shouldn't have woken me. You should have just done it.
I owed you the dignity of choice.
I fell silent. I knew he was right. Every path I had taken in my life, from the moment Madame Kleinfelter removed the growth inhibitor from my forearm, had been of my own choosing. Absurd as it was to speak of feeling resentment from the perspective of being dead, that is how I would have felt had I been denied this final say in my affairs. I hope I would have extended you the same courtesy, Hesperus. We're sentients. We deserve that much.
I sense that your mind is settled.
I felt more weary than saddened. What choice do we have? It's simple. Every other option has already been exhausted. You can't slow us down. That cordon won't stop us. The line couldn't stop us. Good shatterlings have died trying, when we could least afford to lose any more of them. I'll be one more death, but that's a small price to pay, isn't it? I'm not even sure why we're debating it. One human life, one robot life? To spare the galaxy a macro war between the machine and the organic? I shouldn't hesitate. I should have already told you to do it instead of talking about it.
I thought you might like to send a final message to Campion. His ship will keep a record of it until he awakes.
Thank you.
You may speak at your leisure, Purslane.
There was less to say now, but the words came with even greater difficulty. This is Purslane. You've followed me all this way, and I'm more grateful than you'll ever realize. I'm sorry about what happened to the others, to Bettany and the rest. We did everything we could, but in the end it wasn't enough. I'm going to destroy Silver Wings now. It's the only thing left for us to do. It'll be fast, and I won't feel anything. Clean and bright, a good way to go. Turn around and find the line again, Campion. Speak for me at my funeral. Make me a memorial, and then get on with your life. I love you, and I will always love you. Hesperus lowered his face.
It's done. The signal is transmitted. Dalliance will receive it shortly.
You're certain of that?
Beyond all doubt.
I looked at the displayer again, with the black circle of the star dam and the red icons of that useless, soon-to-be-decimated cordon. There was no sense asking if anything had changed. The message I'd already sent would still not have reached them, and there would be precious little time for them to act even when it did. I don't think there's much point in delaying this, is there? The longer we drag things out, the more chance there is of the opener triggering.
That is always a possibility. But I wish to make one suggestion. The likelihood of you surviving the excursion is not good, but you may maximize your chances by re-entering stasis. By some great good fortune, your casket may come through unscathed.
Great good fortune. That's encouraging.
I do not wish to overstate your chances.
Point taken, Hesperus. But how would you rate yours?
Rather unpromising, if I am compelled to be truthful, but that changes nothing. If our roles were reversed, I feel certain that you would want me to do all in my power to survive, even if the likelihood of that survival was small.
I could not argue with that, as much as I would have liked to. I'll go back to the Ark. I can set the stasis casket myself.
No, that would achieve nothing. To stand a chance of surviving, you would be better off as far from the Ark and Silverwing's own engine as circumstances allow. Fortunately, there is such a place. During my peregrinations, I found a secret room containing an armored stasis chamber, protected by multiple impassors. It is very near the bows, not far from our present position. You must have built it as a precaution against such a situation as this, your being compelled to remain aboard during a catastrophic engine failure.
I had no conscious recollection of doing such a thing. I built it.
There's no question, Purslane. I may only have known you for a fraction of your existence, but I recognize your handiwork. You did well to think ahead.
just as I did well to stop anyone tampering with the opener.
You cannot blame yourself for that. You never envisaged that you would be the person trying to sabotage it.
You'd better tell me how to get to this secret room.
I programmed it into the go-board. Enter Terminus. The whiskway will carry you there.
A secret whiskway as well as a secret room?
This is a big ship. It has space enough for a few surprises.
Thank you, Hesperus. It won't help, but it'll give me something to pin my hopes on. At least when I go into stasis, it won't be in the absolute and certain knowledge that I'm going to die. There'll be a chink of light, for me, anyway.
I have had my share of lucky escapes. There is nothing to say I will not profit from another. Go, Perslane.
There were 1,000 things I could have said to him, 1,000 questions I wanted to ask, but every second that passed was another second in which the opener might activate, sending its irrevocable command to the Stardam. I said goodbye. I left the bridge and went to the whisking chamber. I punched in the command Hesperus had given me and steeled myself. In the last instant before the field engaged, it occurred to me that he might have been lying, that there might be no such thing as a secret room, and that the whiskway was going to send me into painless oblivion by dashing me against a sealed wall. But the field snapped, the whiskway transported me, swerved onto a track I did not know existed, and after a confusion of blurred rushing spaces I arrived somewhere. It was a room, but not one I recognized. As I stepped out of the chamber, darkness yielded to light. The space was smaller even than Silverwing's bridge, little larger than a lounge or kitchen. The walls were square and metallic with bolt-like reinforcements. The room contained nothing except the emergency survival device Hesperus had already described. I recognized it. It was a green cube, densely patterned with mouldings depicting castles and palaces, knights and princesses, ponies and dragons and sea serpents. It was palatial, or at least a clever replica of that ancient game. I must have brought it with me all the way from the Golden Hour, across 6 million years. It was exactly as I remembered it. I walked in through the portal in one green face of the cube. Instead of the glowing holographic landscape of the kingdom, with the Palace of Cloud centermost, there was only a stasis casket, surrounded by multiple impasse generators. Why here? I asked myself, but if I did not have the answer, it was unlikely anyone else would. I settled myself into the seat. In an emergency situation, there was no sense in selecting anything other than the highest possible stasis ratio. I moved the controls to 1,000,000. If Silverwings was destroyed, I might be rescued by one of the ships of the Cordon within months or years of planetary time. On the other hand, I might sail right past them, destined to fall through space for tens of thousands of years. This time at least I was prepared for an extended stay. Before the restraints tightened, I dropped synchromesh into my eyes. The combination of mesh, stasis, and relativistic time dilation would keep me alive until I was on the other side of the galaxy. Hesperus, I asked, as the chamber warned me that stasis was about to be initiated. Can you hear me?
Of course, Perslane.
I'm about to go under. I just wanted to say...
There is no need to say anything. I was and will remain your friend.
I hope you can forgive us for the things we did.
Machines may do awful things to the organic if we are not successful. One day, we may both need forgiveness. Until then you have both my forgiveness and my thanks.
Hesperus, I asked. But there was no answer. The restraints began to tighten. Before they bound me into immobility, I set my chronometer and let the synchromesh take effect. Then I was in stasis, and I had time for exactly 2 coherent thoughts. The first was that I was still alive. The second was that we had almost certainly failed.